Today's show is brought to you by Five Nights in Vegas, a new romance by Elizabeth Stokes. It's about meeting, getting married, and falling in love in that order. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new Ghostbusters, The Infiltrator, De Palma, and Love Between the Covers. Ooh, my. News, trailer park, box office predictions, and the home cinema roundup are also on the chopping block. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the interwebs at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Thank you, Ron Burgundy. It's been a slow news week in terms of movies and other things. Most of the news that's happening is blowback from everything that's gone on in the last week, inside and outside of movies. Don't worry, for all you news junkies, the Republican National Convention starts this week. So the moment Trump opens his mouth in Cleveland, there's going to be plenty of stuff that's going to be talked about. But right now, let's take news, set it aside, and I want to have a plea for people in general to start acting like adults. This isn't about politics or movies in particular, but we've seen it happen very recently. And it's ironic I'm giving this little diatribe after giving out my Facebook and Twitter account. But we all know that social media exploded in the last week with just a lot of emotion and venom, with people shooting off insults and barbs at each other throughout the online world. And there are all these tensions going on in just the general media. But then this week there was something happened. I'm not going to go into the details of it because it's kind of inside baseball, especially for me. But it's a hubbub that happened in online film criticism in the community this week. And it was unnecessary, and it escalated because people in and out of the situation were so eager to comment and engage with only part of the information. And everyone was right, when in reality there was wrongdoing on all sides. It wouldn't have happened without Facebook and Twitter and social media that brings together drama queens with brittle egos. And similarly, we saw in this last week, tensions online reach a ludicrous degree. People fighting while only knowing part of a story, or not caring to even know the rest of the story. People taking sides when the sides they should be taking are humanity and civility. Like how Misha Barton, actress and model Misha Barton, was tarred and feathered online, not because of what she said, but what she was wearing and where she was in the picture that she posted this comment on with Instagram. It's utter insanity. And it seems that everybody is engaging in it. Calm down, people. Facebook and Twitter and other social media, it's a great tool. It brings a lot of people together. I've met friends on social media. I have reignited old friendships and relationships with people. I've gotten in touch with people I haven't seen in decades. In some ways, social media is a great thing, but it's also a road to ruin at times. People on social media don't treat other people like people. Just because there's a computer screen between you and those you're interacting with does not mean you're not dealing with a real person. And this is nothing new. I mean, the same thing happened with message boards and bulletin boards 15, 20 years ago. It's just now more common and accessible and widespread. And saying, oh, it's my Facebook page, I can post whatever I want to, it's my page, isn't exactly the truth. Because whatever you post on your page is propagated to the timeline of everyone in your friends list. You're being obnoxious. If you want to sound off on these things, buy a freaking diary and learn to write with a pen. The old saying used to be, if you can't say something nice to someone, don't say anything at all. Well, I propose a new one for 2016. If you wouldn't say it to someone's face, don't put it on social media. If people went about their normal day like they do on social media, I'm not talking about liking food posts and, oh, here's pictures of my kid. I'm talking about the real abhorrent behavior. Like they'd yell out political opinions on the street corner. Now, in real life, that's something that only an insane person would do. Or they slide photocopies of Fringe magazine articles on everyone's desk at work and say, worth a read. But in real life, only social pariahs do that. They'd interject themselves into every random conversation in the office or classroom or the sidewalk. But in real life, those people are considered wholly obnoxious. People are getting fights over what is or is not in a hashtag. They're getting in fights and calling each other caustic names because of whether or not they like a movie or even want to see it. People are shunning people because of the politicians they like, whether or not those people make a big deal out of it or not. This isn't just about movies and online criticism, and it's not just about politics. People have to act like adults, and right now more people than I ever thought would are acting like petulant schoolchildren. And, you know, when my kids, who are all in school, would be bothered by bullies, obnoxious classmates, or just annoying kids, I'd tell them it gets worse when you get older. Only in the adult world, there's no playground supervisor to tell people to behave. We're supposed to do that for ourselves. So grow up, America. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. Taking a nice diversion from my rant earlier about social media. Just dial it back, people. Come on. Let's talk about some new trailers that have dropped for movies that are coming out soon. Both of these are fall movies. The first one, A Monster Calls, opens on October 21st.
How does the story begin?
With a boy. Too old to be a kid.
You're coming to live with me. Don't touch anything.
Be cold. From monster.
Whoa, indeed.
This is based on a beloved book, and it looks very charming and heartwarming and also heartbreaking. I've not read the book. And I'm not terribly familiar with the director, but I'll tell you, this really reminds me of the movie Where the Wild Things Are. If you remember that from, oh gosh, five, six, seven years ago, Spike Jonze did that one, and he gave a really unique spin to Maurice Sendak's Where the Wild Things Are book, and added much more depth and angst and suicidal tendencies into that movie. This one looks very charming. It's about a kid who's finding a way to cope with his mother, who appears to be dying. And she's played by Felicity Jones, who I'm a huge fan of. Sigourney Weaver's also in this movie. And Liam Neeson does the voice of the monster. And it looks like it's going to be one of those award films that doesn't get any awards. It's going to possibly get a couple nods here and for some more fringe groups. But the Oscars will ignore this. But it does look like it's going to be quite a charming movie. Looking forward to it. The next one I want to talk about is Loving, opens November 4th.
Richie! What you doing in bed with that woman?
I'm his wife.
That's no good here.
Richard Perry Loving, being a white person, and Mildred Jeter, being a colored person, did unlawfully cohabitate as man and wife.
Richard!
It ain't right!
I believe this is a battle that could go all the way to the Supreme Court.
We ain't heard anybody.
If you couldn't guess from the trailer, it is not a big screen adaptation of the 80s soap opera, Loving. This is instead based on a true story about a man and a woman, a white man and a black woman in Virginia who got married. And then, of course, the authorities came down hard on them because it violated marriage laws. And what's interesting, it seems like it's the movie that should have been a separate movie broken out of Free State of Jones, because there's a whole subplot of interracial marriage in that movie. But that movie was so full of all these different concepts and things thrown on the wall, and some of them stuck and some of them didn't, that this is an interesting one to have as his own movie. Now, it's directed by Jeff Nichols, who did movies like Midnight Special, and he did Mud. And Mud's a very down-to-earth movie. There's no supernatural element to it, which there is in Take Shelter and Midnight Special. So it looks like Loving is going to be a little more along those lines. And it looks like it's going to be good. In fact, it looks like it's where Jeff Nichols' strength is. A lot of people like his sort of supernatural elements to it, but I get annoyed with it because he just sort of minimalizes them and marginalizes them. This is all character. So this could be a good movie. It opens on November 4th. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to start the movie reviews with The Infiltrator and De Palma. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies. Let's kick off the movie reviews with The Infiltrator. Bryan Cranston stars in this true story of an undercover federal agent who goes after Pablo Escobar by laundering his money.
Washington wants the biggest bust in history. Pablo Escobar
and his main distributor, Roberto Alcano.
Mazur, you're partnering with Abreu.
I think we've been doing this backwards. We've been following the drugs to get to the bad guys. What if we chase the money?
We need to find new undercover identities.
Here we go. Bob Mussella.
Welcome to a life of crime.
This one actually came out earlier in the week. It came out Wednesday. Technically, it came out Tuesday night. Because they always do preview nights ahead of time, which is great, especially for someone like me. But this is the only big movie opening against Ghostbusters, which is, of course, the big one of the weekend. It's a much smaller movie, and it's Bryan Cranston trying to get that movie career that he missed when he was younger, and now that he has Breaking Bad under his belt, he is trying to do something more and something different. And by doing something more and something different, he has to kind of gravitate towards his Walter White character. And in a lot of ways, this reminds you a lot of Breaking Bad, because he plays this suburban husband who has an alternate identity. And now in this one, he's, of course, an undercover agent playing a money launderer in Florida, trying to bust up the Colombian drug cartels from the U.S. And going, instead of going after the drugs and going up the chain that way, he figured, go follow the money and that'll take him there. And it of course, leads to some very significant things. If you know your history, you'll know what happens. I'm not going to go through it because it is tend to be spoilery. But he does have sort of a Walter White character to him, where, of course, Walter White in Breaking Bad was just this sort of nerdy science teacher. And in his alternate ego, he was Heisenberg, who was this ruthless drug dealer. And he had to become the ruthless drug dealer. And in this one, he has to kind of become this ruthless money launderer. I mean, he's not a drug dealer, but he deals with drug dealers. So, of course, he has to mix it up with the criminal element. Now, he's got his friend, his partner, is played by John Leguizamo, and he's a little more into the undercover business than Bryan Cranston's character. Bryan Cranston's character's kind of learning his ropes, and he's new to this whole thing, and which causes some mess-ups. It causes some wrinkles in the plan, because when you go undercover, you gotta fully commit. So that means you gotta take drugs, you gotta drink, you gotta party, you gotta be with the women, you gotta do all the stuff that all the drug dealers do, or you're gonna look like an narc. You can't be like, I'm sorry, I don't do drugs. You're in the drug business. You should probably do some. So he does struggle with that. And there's parts about this movie that I thought were really good. I thought that Cranston's performance was great in it, as was John Leguizamo's. Now, some of the people as the bad guys, Benjamin Bratt's in it, and he's okay. He sort of just plays these stock characters. He's either a cop or a drug dealer nowadays. That's all Benjamin Bratt pretty much does. And his part feels very recycled. Diane Kruger plays Bryan Cranston's fake wife in the undercover bit. And she's okay. I when she came on screen, I was like, oh, where's she been keeping herself? Because Diane Kruger came on really strong about 10 years ago. And never quite clicked. She was in some big movies. She was in Troy, and she was in the National Treasure franchise. But she was never a big movie star. You never saw her break out. And so she's showing up again, which is nice, because she's okay, and she's attractive to look at. But this movie seems to, at times, just go a little bit too much through the ropes. And it goes through stuff that we've seen before with behind the scenes drug infiltration movies. It's a crime drama, but not quite. And at times it tries to make you feel sympathy for these people because, of course, Bryan Cranston's characters getting to know them very well. But I don't think it quite hits the mark on that. And it does it sometimes extremely awkwardly and bizarrely, especially when it comes to Benjamin Bratt's character. It runs a bit long because it's like over 2 hours. But if this is your kind of movie, you might enjoy it. It reminds me a little bit of Kill the Messenger from last year. That's the one with Jeremy Renner, which was him sort of a journalist trying to uncover the Iran-Contra scandal. And it had some really interesting intrigue, and then it kind of gets bogged down with him sort of trying to fight for his reputation back. And this one does get bogged down at times. It's a good performance, but I mean, it's going to be a forgettable movie. I mean, seriously, by August, no one's going to remember this movie. It's not going to be remembered for any sort of awards. And I think that's what it was kind of hoping it would be going for. So The Infiltrator, I'm actually going to say it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about De Palma. This long-form conversation with director Brian De Palma examines all of his movies from an inside perspective.
What we did in our generation will never be duplicated. You're battling a very difficult system, and all the values of that system are the opposite of what goes into making original good movies. You can lose your way. When you do some of these things, they make perfect logical sense to you, and then you put them in front of an audience, they go, holy cow.
Watching this movie pointed out to me how many De Palma films, especially early De Palma films, I have not yet seen. I've always thought I've seen most of his filmography. And there's some big ones I haven't seen. I've never seen Blowout. I know people who love Blowout. And I know it didn't do well. And obviously now I know the ending because they talk about it in this film. But that's one that's kind of always been on my list. And he has one that came out recently called Passion, which kind of looks not very good. But he hasn't, in my opinion, really done anything really strong in almost 20 years. I mean, I think my personal favorite is The Untouchables. It's a fantastic movie. But he also, you forget how influential he was in the 70s and also in the 60s, but really in the 70s and even into the 80s. And then kind of when he did Mission Impossible, that was his last really big, well-done movie. And I admire the ambition of Mission to Mars. I admire kind of what he was trying to do with like Femme Fatale and Snake Eyes. But they're not great movies. But what's neat about this film, even if you're not a fan of Brian De Palma, this film breaks down his movies pretty well. So if you've not seen his movies, check them out first. If there's any of them you don't want spoiled because they talk about everything all the way to the end. But he's done some fantastic movies, and it's almost like a film commentary track, which I don't get to listen to as much as I used to, but I've always loved those because it gets the inside look at the movie. And it, essentially all this is just one giant interview with Brian De Palma, and then they show clips from his movies. But it's a very condensed and it's very dense with information and knowledge, and he addresses a lot of the things like the blood, like the violence against women, like him being kind of, he wouldn't say imitator of Hitchcock. He believes he took what Hitchcock started and made it bigger. But there's a lot of people who just consider him an imitator of Hitchcock and what he tried to do with each movie and how each one led to the next and how there are some of his that he particularly likes that I don't like Dressed to Kill, and that did very well. And then there's movies that bombed and that I kind of liked, like Bonfire of the Vanities. You know, granted, I never read the book. And I think that is the tipping point. They even say that in the film. So if you are at all interested in Brian De Palma's work, if you're at all interested in his films, this is definitely one to check out. De Palma rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about one of the most talked about films of the summer, and that is Ghostbusters. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies. Let's continue with the movie reviews by hitting what could be considered the most anticipated and buzzed about movie of the year. And that is Ghostbusters, the remake, 2016. I'm only going to do one review for this segment. And the reason is there's a lot to say about Ghostbusters. And it's not just because of what the movie is. I mean, I can review this movie in like 3 minutes or less. It's a pretty easy movie to talk about. There's so much baggage that has come along with Ghostbusters. I think it's worthwhile talking about it. And I've talked a little bit about it as it was being developed. And I talked about it a couple weeks ago in the trailer park. But I think now that it's out, let's sort of review some of the things that are going around. All these witches stirring the brew. The first thing is kind of give just a little bit of a history of the thing. Originally, it started out that they were trying to do a Ghostbusters 3 for years. And they just couldn't get a good script. Bill Murray was like supposedly the one who was standing in the way of it, and he says he's game as long as there was a good script, and they've been talking about doing it literally since 1989, which is when Ghostbusters 2 came out, that everyone forgets was terrible. And if they had done a Ghostbusters 3, it probably would have been as bad as Ghostbusters 2. It's not the same. These guys are old, and then Harold Ramis died, and they realized, well, that ship has sailed, because you obviously wouldn't have the four original Ghostbusters. So they decided to redevelop it as a female Ghostbusters. That was the big thing. And it caused so much anger online, and it was immediately misconstrued. Honestly, I think what bothers people is that they're not giving it a serious remake. It's kind of like when they remade Psycho. And people are like, why remake Psycho? That's a great movie. You don't need to remake it. And they're like, well, and our gimmick is we're going to use the exact same shooting script and the exact same storyboards that after. And people are like, well, that's just a gimmick at that point. And that's, I think, what people, that's the immediate gut reaction is people are like, it's not that they were women. It's that it was stunt casting. It was guys, it's Ghostbusters, but with girls, which just feels like a gimmick. It doesn't actually feel like any sort of creativity. It's like when I was in music class in like middle school and the teacher came in and said, we're going to do this original song, but we're going to make it a rap. That'll be new and different and that'll get the kids involved. And it just felt like a stunt. And from that point forward, it didn't have the fans with it. And everyone says, oh, it's because they're sexist. I really don't think it's because they're sexist. I think it's just that they didn't like the gimmick idea. And then when they finally came out with the cast, it did seem a bit flavor of the month because Paul Feig was directing it. So he brought Kristen Wiig and Melissa McCarthy from Bridesmaids to do it. And all three of those people, Wiig, McCarthy, and Feig, aren't as big as they were back when Bridesmaids came out. They kind of made their careers, all three of them. But yeah, Feig did the heat. Melissa McCarthy had a couple hits. But, you know, Kristen Wiig, I mean, she's been in big movies like The Martian, but that's not why the movie did well. Nobody gives a crap that she was in The Martian. But yeah, it's technically a movie she's in. And then the trailer started coming out and they weren't terribly inspired. So it just fanned the flames. Now that we're up to speed, let's talk about the movie. Four women join forces to study ghosts while a mysterious person is amplifying paranormal activity throughout New York City.
We have a gift. We see what no one else is willing to see. We do things others can't do.
Ghostbusters.
If there's a paranormal problem, we're the ones to answer the call.
Hello.
What do we think of these Ghostbusters? Are they to be taken seriously?
There's a bigger picture at hand here.
Someone is creating a device that amplifies paranormal activity.
First off, was it any good? It's okay. I have to say, I didn't hate it. It's an enjoyable movie. It's not terrible, but it's not a new classic. It's entirely forgettable as well. But I mean, there's things about it that I thought were really good. I laughed at certain times. It didn't seem to go on too long. I brought my 8-year-old. We went and got green slime Twinkies, and they had marshmallow Twinkies too. And we ate those and we drank Ecto Cooler while we were watching the movie. It was a lot of fun to spend some time with my son, but it wasn't like groundbreaking. The original was groundbreaking. This isn't that. But there's things I did like. One of the things I did like is they don't reshoot the exact thing. It's not even like Kristen Wiig's playing Bill Murray's character and Melissa McCarthy's playing Harold Ramis's character. They're very different characters. All the three main girls, and then of course Leslie Jones. She's the only one I didn't like. Overall, the cast was good, but I did not like Leslie Jones. She's awful. And the reason she's awful is because it's a one-note stereotype character. And that's a stereotype that's older than the movie itself. There's nothing new about anything she does. And that's different than Ernie Hudson. When Ernie Hudson showed up in the original Ghostbusters, he was just an average guy looking for a job. He didn't come in as a raging black stereotype in the 80s. He was just the guy. He was kind of known as the Black Ghostbusters, and he came in after the three of them had established it. But ultimately, he was just another guy. He was the average guy. He was the audience surrogate in a lot of ways, so they could be goofy and weird and talk about paranormal activity. He could be like, what are you talking about? He's like a companion in Doctor Who. But Leslie Jones, she's just the obnoxious black woman, and it's just the jokes are old, and it's, you're like, I get it, you're black. Move on to something new. She's terrible in it. And I mean, unfortunately, I did not like her in it. The rest of the cast is fine. In fact, I mean, I'm normally annoyed with Kristen Wiig and sometimes annoyed with Melissa McCarthy, but I thought they both did good jobs. And Kate McKinnon, now this is interesting because Kate McKinnon, she's getting all the praise. Everyone's like, oh my God, she's the greatest ever. Oh. And people are like, she's a revelation. She's perfect. And here's the thing with, there are some things she does in the movie that are very, very funny. And her character is kind of a microcosm for the movie itself. There are some parts that are very funny and have some great gags and great jokes. And then there are some that just don't hit. They don't stick the landing. And she's got the highest proportion of those. There are some things that she does that are hilarious, but there's other things she does that I recall myself thinking, God, this is really bad. And it's because they probably improv'd a lot of stuff. That's sort of the Saturday Night Live handbook. Now, the funniest parts, I thought, were where it was kind of meta. There's a couple jokes about sexism in there, and they're kind of funny because it's a wink and the nod to the audience. But that's a little risky because you don't know if that's going to live past the news story. The movie may be obsolete in a year because people look, oh yeah, I guess there was a big hubbub about that. So yeah, there are some things that don't work. And there are some things that even when they get meta and they start making the sexist jokes that don't work either. For example, there's a joke in there and I'm going to give it away. I'm going to give away the joke. And they're talking about how something that Kate McKinnon's character built didn't have safety switches. And she's like, oh, safety switches are for dudes. I understand what the joke was. It was like saying safety switches are for girls. But the thing is, when you gender swap that joke, it doesn't play. It doesn't work. I see what they were going for, but it just plain doesn't work because it just doesn't work as a joke. And that's the problem with a little bit too much of the meta humor. And on top of it, finally, the third act gets a little pear-shaped. It kind of goes all over the place. You really felt like the first movie was building to something, and this one wasn't. And there's something in the credit sequence that you can tell they cut out. And you're like, oh my God, I could imagine how horrible it would have been if they've left that in. Like Neighbors 2, it has a very high Rotten Tomatoes reading. And if you read the blurb, a whole bunch of them are aggressively political. About from a neo-feminist angle. And some of them shamelessly plug McKinnon and like a publicist on crack. Like, for example, here's just a sampling of it. Peter Travis from Rolling Stones goes, angry nerds, take notes. The ladies are the best thing about the franchise reboot. Amy Nicholson from MTV, a middle finger to the screaming Brobazis. If the girls can't be Ghostbusters, then here, guys can't do anything. And of course, to top it off is Andrew here. From Salon.com, who says, a fresh set of scares and laughs and a moderate dose of girl power that is unlikely to seem confrontational to anyone beyond the most confirmed basement-dwelling Gamergate troll. Wow, I think he wins sexist online bingo. Yeah. The reality is there is a certain underlying sexist tone in there, and it has nothing to do with reverse sexism. And it's the fact that it's a female Ghostbusters, but a guy had to direct it. They mirrored the cast! But they also needed hunky Chris Hemsworth to fill out a minor role that was kind of disposable in the first movie. And he's critical to the third act. You don't have a third act without Chris Hemsworth. You could completely remove Annie Potts out of the original one. You still have a movie. In the end, even if Ghostbusters is a hit, even if it only goes halfway, it still proves that Hollywood needs a man to be in charge of the movies. And that's not true. And that's not good. But in the end, I still kind of liked it. Ghostbusters kind of rocked.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for Busting the Ghosts. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to review Love Between the Covers, talk about the box office, and give you the home cinema roundup.
Who you going to call? Ghostbusters!
Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews with a final film. This is a little different than the stuff I normally review. This actually is just going on demand. It's available right now if you want to go on Amazon or iTunes. And it is a documentary about romance novels. And there's a reason for this. It's not that I'm like gravitating towards romance novels or anything. It's just that my wife is a huge fan. My wife is one of those people, she's a teacher, so she gets the summers off. Well, a chunk of the summers off because she works into the summer and at the end of the summer too. She really gets about maybe 60% of the time that the kids do get off. But during that time that she's at home and we're just sitting around the house and she's can relax and recharge for the year, she's one of those people that'll read a book a day. And she loves trashy romance. And I say trashy romance with love. That is not me minimalizing it or marginalizing it. It's like me saying, I love stupid comedies. I do. I love stupid comedies. Trashy romance means that it's very disposable literature, which is great. There's nothing wrong with that. Not everything needs to be War and Peace. You know, not everything needs to be this dense literary masterpiece that takes hours to read a 2-page section and has so much depth of, sometimes you just want to read for entertainment and it's disposable and that's okay. And that, in fact, that's good. There is nothing wrong with enjoying popular fiction in whatever form it is, whether it's comic books, whether it's romance books, whether it's sci-fi tie-in series, you know, whether it's fan fiction, whether it's slash fiction. If you're a big Kirk and Spock guy or woman, then that's great. It's entertainment. That is what it's for. You should never feel ashamed of yourself for liking to read something. Unless it's Mein Kampf. And then you might want to be a little bit ashamed. But, you know, romance is great. And it's a huge business. And so I got a press release for this and I said, oh, this is an interesting movie. And one of the women who's the writers featured in the film is Nora Roberts, who's one of my wife's favorite authors. So I'm like, hey, let's get this and we'll watch it together. I want to get your take on it too. So we watched it together and she enjoyed it. So yeah, it's a movie. It's called Love Between the Covers, and the joke being covers, not just the covers of the bed. It's a play on words. Haha, covers of a book. They still have them. It's not just all Kindle. This documentary examines the wildly popular genre and subgenres of romance fiction by profiling some of its most prolific authors.
Yeah, we're the one to keep the lights on.
Some pretty powerful women doing this.
Professional women.
Professional, powerful geneticists, astrophysicists, mm-hmm. Lawyers, doctors.
Okay, let me get this straight. You were writing 3 books a year while you were a surgeon.
Mm-hmm.
And when did you fit that in?
At night.
It isn't so much that fans or readers find you, but they find each other.
Romance readers are the readers who will read a book a day. They're voracious readers.
Like I said, I have nothing against romance books. I don't necessarily read them, but romance is a completely legitimate series. And there's nothing wrong with it being fantasy. They even go in the movie, they make the point, they said it's fantasy. There's nothing wrong with Happily Ever After. You see that all the time in popular movies. You see that all the time in science fiction. You see that all the time, even in horror movies. There's nothing wrong with it. And it's the biggest genre out there. And part of it is because the romance authors who know what they're doing, and there's a lot of them out there, they write disposable works. They write stuff that you can read in a day. And people don't just want to reread the same books. They want to read a whole series. And so these authors who are prolific enough to write 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 or more books a year, especially now, and they sort of, at near the end, they address self-publishing. And of course, the people who are diehard editors and those who come from the old school, you know, say, oh, no, that's trash. No. There's a complete legitimacy to self-publishing. And now the investment is low enough that it's almost nothing. And that's what makes it accessible. Now, with that accessibility, you get a lot of crap out there and you get a lot of poorly done books. And you got a lot of books that are replete with spelling errors and grammar and layout problems. But you know what? If you're just some person sitting in their apartment writing a book and you don't have disposable income, you can't pay somebody a couple hundred dollars to proofread your work. You can't spend thousands of dollars to get somebody to photograph and do model fees and clearances to do the cover. You may have to just rely on stock photography and your own Photoshop skills. The most inspiring thing about this movie is the do-it-yourself nature that is available to you. Now, if you can't write, you can't write. Tough beans. You're not going to learn to be a romance author who can write a half dozen books a year if you don't know how to write or you're not good at it. So, you know, just back off on that. But if you have a talent for writing and you want to do it, it's very accessible. And there is this voracious audience for it. And now it's accessible through online publishing. And of course, then if you make some money, then yeah, get a real editor. But, you know, get yourself out there first. You know, it's like doing a podcast and turning it into a radio show. I know somebody that happened to. Now, it's very much a fan movie of romance. It shows a very sort of warm and cuddly version of it. And yeah, it shows some of the struggles that people do, but it doesn't show real heartache in there. There's some great characters in it. But, I mean, there are certain things that they don't show at all. Like, there are guys that write romances. And they even mention it sort of peripherally. But most of the romance authors are women, or at the very least, they have female names. You know, there are a lot of writers who write under pen names, and not just Nora Roberts writing under multiple names. There are guys who write romance books and make plenty of money doing it and are beloved, but aren't known for, you know, having different genitalia. In fact, I remember seeing this interview with Dean Koontz, who used to be involved in some publishing guild or something. And there was a guy who was a romance writer, and he wanted to go meet his fans at the Romance Writers Association yearly meeting, and Koontz was like, no, because you will lose all those fans when they realize you're a big fat slob guy. With all the talk about Ghostbusters being the female empowerment movie, that's not the most female empowerment movie this weekend. It's Love Between the Covers, because it shows a lot of successful women taking charge of their lives. And if you really want to support girl power, that's the movie you should check out. Love Between the Covers kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. Last week, I said that Secret Life of Pets was going to win. I underballed it insanely low with $65 million. It made over $100 million. It made $104 million, which is awesome for that movie. And it's significant because it's right up there with the Pixar level of movie making. And it also almost matches what Minions made over its opening weekend last year. And that shows that Illumination Animation Studios is actually getting some traction. And they've got not just now Despicable Me and Minions, they now got these pets going. So they've got a franchise. They got a bona fide franchise they can start. Which is, don't mess it up in the second movie. Don't get Paul Feig to direct it with a bunch of females. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I'm kidding. Anyways, there was also Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates, and that came out last week. That came in with just under $17 million, which is okay for what that is. Wasn't going to make a ton of money. It didn't have any really huge names on the poster, but it'll eventually leg itself out to be a profitable film. And that's fine, because I thought it was a funny movie. This week, the big question is, what's Ghostbusters going to make? Can Ghostbusters actually beat The Secret Life of Pets? Now, I think Secret Life of Pets is about pegged to make about $60 million this week, almost what I predicted last week, but that's just sort of the regression. It's going to drop 50-some percent, and it's the main movie for kids. Now, Ghostbusters does give a little bit of competition for kids, but I think Ghostbusters is going to struggle. Good reviews, good Rotten Tomato score alone, you're still going to have to drag the fanboys out. And it's become so politicized that I think there are some people that are just leery of it. Because you can't say whether or not you want to see the movie without suddenly saying you're a sexist or you're a feminist. It's okay to not want to see Ghostbusters. And I actually saw somebody point out on Twitter, the studio needed to have a different marketing message than, if you don't like our movie, you're a misogynistic pig. I think it's going to make more than the lowest predictions, but I don't think it's going to become a big hit. It's not going to make over $60 million, I'm pretty sure. But it could make in the 40s. I think that's a safe bet, which is going to be right about what Independence Day and Tarzan have done. And that's going to fit in line with another line of movies that all cost almost the exact same amount of money and make about the same amount of money. It's not opening in China, so it's not going to get the overseas bump. But because of the current state of the neo-feminism reporting that we're getting, it's going to be heralded as a slap in the face to all the knuckle-dragging, mouth-breathing haters out there, even though that's not true. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. This week on DVD and Blu-ray, you've got Allegiant, which is the third Divergent film. It's the first half of the third book. It's kind of a mess. Not very good. Got some great special effects, but the story's in the toilet. There's also Green Room, which is one of Anton Yelchin's final films. A very good movie. Very grisly and intense and scary at times, about these rockers who are trapped in a club by white supremacists. Miracles from Heaven, which is cute enough. I mean, it's a faith-based movie, so it's got a lot of those foibles, but it hits the points it's supposed to hit. Everybody Wants Some, that is Richard Linklater's new film, or most recent film, about baseball players in college in the 80s. There's Colony Season 1, which is from the Sci-Fi Channel, starring Sawyer from Lost, whatever his name is. There's also iZombie, Season 1 and 2 is on DVD and Blu-ray as well. That's it for this week. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Ice Age, Collision Course, Star Trek Beyond, Lights Out, and Absolutely Fabulous, Darling. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.